Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 10, delivered on September 20, 2018. The title of this lecture is Ethics.
Today, ethics. And I'm going to bring with me to this table some stories, actual stories. Now, the thing with ethics, as I'm supposed to teach it to you, I'm supposed to teach you laws, the laws of the state of Illinois, the federal laws, thou shalt not this, thou shalt not that. Screw them. Ethics isn't law. It is something else. So I'm going to start with a real story, and I'm going to ask you to finish the story. I'm going to just go around and ask you what you would have done. Now, imagine you could do something that would make you rich beyond your wildest dreams. $2 billion. And all you have to do is say four magic words. And by the way, this is not a fiction. This is really what happened one day. Four magic words, and you will be $2 billion richer. And your little lackeys around you and some people in the shadows will be following you, and they'll become rich too. Not as rich as you will, but they'll do great. And your lackey comes up to you, and one of them, and says, what do we do? You got four words that you could say, or you could say two words. The four words will make you rich beyond your wildest dreams. The two words, you won't become rich beyond your wildest dreams. Now, let's qualify this a little bit. In order for you, if you say the four words, you will destroy an economy. You will wreck a central bank. You will send an economy that was already teetering into recession into a terrible, long recession that will change the social and political landscape of that country forever. You will have millions of people lose their jobs. Poverty will become rampant. Households will break up. People will kill themselves. Children will get sick. There will even be rumors of the return of the king. That's King Cholera. Have you ever seen cholera? Little babies shit themselves until they dehydrate and die. All you have to do is say four words, though. And you can say, well, it was their own fault for getting themselves into the situation where I could do this. Now, ever after that, if you're rich, you will have your praises sung. You will become the greatest philanthropist of all time, possibly. You will give money to social causes. A political party will stand and applaud you every time you walk into a room. The only people who will possibly say you were a bad person are crazy, crazy-ass right-wing nutcases and neo-fascists. The few who are moderates who talk about you, they will be labeled as crazy neo-fascists like Alex Jones and his neo-Nazis. So you don't really have to worry about that, because everywhere you go, you will live longer than most people could possibly imagine. You will be loved and your praises will be sung. You'll give to schools and the kids will all come out and sing to you when you come to their schools because you gave them money. You'll be a hero to normal people. And any criticism of you would obviously be just from those cray-cray neo-fascists. Okay, what are you going to do? You can say there are four words. The four words are go for the jugular. The two words are stand down. Don't worry, I hold no judgment on you. Stand down, you're a damn liberal leftist. Go for the jugular, you're a real business person. What say you, madam?
I'd probably stand down. I really don't know.
Yes, you do, because you might have to decide someday, so decide now so that you don't have to stand there.
Oh my gosh.
I know, seriously.
Okay, I'd stand down.
I'd stand down.
Ma'am? He's saying, go for the jugular. Don't worry, I'm not holding. This is not a judgment. This was a real decision. Either way you cut it, it has consequences far beyond you. What say you, sir? You. Go for the jugular. Don't just say jugular. He might mean yours and cut your throat. Talk to me. Come on.
No.
No what? Say.
I would not.
Say stand down then. Okay? Don't be. Remember what I told you Arnold Schwarzenegger said many years ago? Don't be a girly man. Okay? Say it. Stand down or go for the jugular. Yes, don't be afraid. Have the courage of your convictions. Either way, have the courage to say the words. Okay, sir, what do you say? Okay, you? Good. Here's how it worked out. Here was the actual scenario. In the 1980s, the countries of Europe had, and England also, had entered into an agreement, what's called an exchange rate mechanism, it was called, an ERM. Essentially, what it would do is these countries would stand together and keep their currencies from moving too far away from each other. Because, you see, if one country's currency becomes too weak, it begins to cause capital to flow out of the country. And if a country's currency becomes too strong, it tends to draw too much capital to it and away from the other countries. It also, a weak currency tends to be a currency that exports too much, and a strong currency tends to import too much. So keeping the countries all in agreement will keep an exchange rate band so that if any of our currencies moves too far away from the other currencies, we'll all intervene to strengthen it if it's too weak, or weaken it if it's too strong. Now remember this, the value of a currency, the price of a currency, or the rental rate technically, is the interest rate environment. So in other words, a country that has very high interest rates will have a very strong currency. It's a valuable currency because its price is high. And a country that has low interest rates will have a weak currency. Its value is very low. So what was happening at the time was that you had all these different European countries involved in it, Germany, France, Italy, the Netherlands, I believe, was in it, Spain. And then, of course, you had England over here that was involved in it. And this was an exchange rate mechanism, an ERM. And the currency stayed within a certain band. All of the currencies stayed in a band with each other. And if any one of them drifted too far, they'd all jump in and help get it back into the band. So let's look at England and Germany. Their exchange rate band, the currency floated, the Deutschmark. Now this was before euros, this was the Deutschmark against the pound sterling. It would bounce around the band. Then something very nasty, and there was an agreement. Well, you know, we're all in this ERM, we all protect each other, and all this. Well, unfortunately, something terrible and wonderful happened in the early 1990s. Communism, the Soviet Union, collapsed. And Germany, West Germany it was, suddenly the Berlin Wall fell, and there was its brother country, East Germany, this miserable basket case, just completely fallen apart from decades of communist mismanagement, just completely opened up. And Germany, West Germany said, well, we're reuniting. We're going to bring that our brother back home. And God, we've got a lot of expensive fixing to do. I mean, everything, the sewers, the water, the healthcare, the transportation, the electricity, it was all Soviet era misery in East Germany. And so West Germany said, well, we're a very strong country. The Bundesbank will finance what we have to do to get you guys back on track. Well, you see, the problem is that Germany began to borrow money. Lots of money. Lots and lots of money. Now, as a country borrows money, the demand for capital drives interest rates up in that country. Seriously up. Germany was borrowing just enormous amounts of money, so interest rates in Germany were rising as the supply of debt on the market increased, the price of debt decreased, so the yields went up. Classic finance. Well, of course, what that meant was that currencies relative to the Deutschmark, as the German Deutschmark went up, other currencies went down. And so this nice, pleasant ERM, exchange rate mechanism band, suddenly the pound sterling is bouncing at the bottom of the band because it was so weak compared to this powerful, massive Deutschmark with high interest rates. The Deutschmark was way up here, and essentially England, the pound sterling, wanted to fall through the bottom. Germany was so busy trying to finance this insanely large project, and the other countries were suffering too. Their interest rates were nothing to compete with Germany, so their currencies were trickling downward, and England was already on the verge of a recession. So England, you know, they couldn't really raise their interest rates to strengthen their currency because they were already in a problematic economy. And so it just kept bouncing down here, bounce, bounce, bounce. And the big thing was so many economists and finance people at the time, bankers, were saying, you've got to walk away from the ERM. Just forget it. But England said, no, we're going to hold on. We're just going to keep selling our gold, doing whatever we can to keep our own currency in the band. We'll buy our own currency back with real gold just to keep it from falling down through the floor because we made an agreement. They're British, honor and all that kind of stuff. Boing, boing, boing. It needed to get way down here. Well, we knew it was going to happen. And we could have controlled the drop. Eventually, the Bank of England was going to have to say, all right, we've abandoned the exchange rate mechanism. And of course, the currency would then drop, but we could control the drop. But they kept holding on and holding on, using their own gold to buy pound sterling to keep the pound from dropping through the floor. Well, a group of currency traders led by a gentleman named George Soros saw this was going to happen. So what they did was they went to banks in England and they borrowed hundreds of millions of dollars of capital in pound sterling, denominated in pound sterling. Hundreds of millions of dollars denominated in pound sterling. And then they used the proceeds to buy Deutschmarks so that when the Bank of England finally gave up and the exchequer of the currency said, we're out of the exchange rate mechanism, we give up, we're done, we're dead. Well, of course, the currency just went boom like that. And then Soros and his team, they simply swapped out. Now the Deutschmark was just going crazy. They swapped out and used some of their Deutschmarks to buy extremely cheap pound sterling, and they paid off these hundreds of millions in loans with insanely cheap pound sterling. So the banks, especially the Bank of England, which was denominating those loans in pound sterling at hundreds of millions of dollars, suddenly got the loans paid off at pennies on the dollar, simply because the pound sterling had collapsed so much between the time that the loans were taken out and when the loans were paid that the Soros and his team made billions of dollars, $3.5 billion, something like that. $2 billion of it was to Soros. Now, the day that this happened, the story goes that Soros's main trade currency trader came to him and he said, okay, this is when we can do it. They had two choices. One, they could just simply do the trade, get some cheapo pound sterling with their extremely valuable Deutschmarks that they had bought with the pound sterling when it was worth more. Or Soros could have gone to the Bank of England and said, let's work. Let's get this done. Let's fix this. I've got all these loans. I'm not going to cash them in at pennies on the dollar. We're just going to figure out a way to control this drop here, bring us back with the money that I've got that was from the Bank of England, with that money and with these strong Deutschmarks, we can bring the currency back into alignment a little bit and soften the drop. That money could have been used, that money that they had borrowed and now was in Deutschmarks, could have been used to buy in and pull the currency back up. But instead, they used the currency to pay off hundreds of millions of dollars in loans at pennies on the dollar, thus causing the collapse of the Bank of England and other banks along the way. The trader said to Soros, what do we do? Soros said, go for the jugular. Instead of stand down, we'll talk to the Bank of England, we'll figure something out. He said, go for the jugular. And so the bank, the central bank, just fell apart because essentially assets, those loans that they had made at hundreds of millions of dollars got paid off in extremely cheap currency. And, of course, that meant that the bank no longer could meet its capital reserve requirements. It was all over. Game over. The Bank of England was out of it, and so there was no way to support the economy. And as a result, then things went south, and the economy that was teetering into a recession dropped into a hard recession. Now, an interesting thing that happens in bad economic times, people tend to blame the government, and people tend to be much more willing to listen to radicals. And that was one of the things that happened, and it happened in the United States at several points. And they listened to neo-fascists, they listened to right-wing conservatives, they listened to communists, but the communists weren't around anymore because they'd been completely humiliated with the fall of the Soviet Union. So the government of Great Britain moved to the right. And really, there's never been a recovery from that time and the bitterness of people about what happened in that time. Interestingly enough, the Ministry of Finance and the people and the members of Parliament were asking, can we order an Interpol intervention and arrest George Soros? And the answer was no. Well, why not? Look what he did. He's violated international law. And this was one of those famous points that was made. Sir, there is no such thing as international law. Stop dreaming. They did what they did. They got by with it. Now stop crying about it and move on. And so did Soros. And that's the name. That's the story there. The problem is that no matter how you describe this, you're going to get someone mad at you. You're going to get either the leftists mad at you because they love Soros, or you're going to get the right-wingers mad at you because you agree with something they say, and then you say they're a bunch of right-wing fascists. Get away from me. So it doesn't matter how you describe this. You're going to get in trouble with everyone. So you know what? Bite me. Now, let me move on. And this allows us a window into what is mealy-mouthed way the word is ethics. And ethics is really a way that we can keep from offending people with stronger words, right and wrong, moral and immoral, or moral and amoral, good and bad. We're not supposed to say good and bad anymore, okay? I went to a restaurant. The potato tasted terrible. I said, waitress, this potato was bad. She came over, she spanked the potato, bad potato, bad potato. I didn't give her much of a tip. Where the hell was I? Okay. Think of a matrix that works like this. And again, you may have noticed that I am very diplomatic. I keep my feelings to myself. I don't use strong words. Like hell I don't. Right, wrong. Legal, illegal. We can divide actions into one of these categories. And in business, you can really do this. Right and legal. You can think of business actions, business decisions that are both ethical, that is right, moral. Or you can think of them legal, but they are wrong. They are just wrong. And you can find all of the excuses you want for why they aren't really wrong, but they are still wrong. Madam, have you ever learned in any of your classes yet the term consumer choice architecture? You've not heard it. Have you taken a marketing class yet? I'm not sure where you are. Madam, have you heard consumer choice architecture? It's the most common part of marketing. From advertising to placement, it is everything, especially in our age. Have you heard of consumer choice architecture? It's simple. You give people a choice, but you structure the offer in such a way that most of them will make the choice you want. Yes, no button. The yes is big, green. The no button is red and slightly smaller. That's consumer choice architecture. We have the inexpensive version of our product with the not very interesting lettering and the no commercials. And then we have the more expensive. The same product, but with colorful stuff and people on TV looking happy and floating slow motion because they have friends. You want friends, don't you? Well, you won't have friends if you buy the cheap stuff, loser. We do it to you all the time, and you are going to do it to consumers. Don't say, well, I ain't going to do this. Well, yeah, you are. And so you can either be the slave or you can be the master. Now, is it right to do that, to trick people, to induce them, to tease them, to cause them to make a choice?
Your business.
Well, yes, but is it right? Say right or wrong. Is it right or wrong to alter people's decisions to be what you want those decisions to be? Is that right or wrong? Just tell me. Well, you know, it's okay if you say right. You know, it doesn't matter. That's the point I'm trying to make. You just have to make the choice for yourself how you're going to proceed. And then recognize that if you're in a business, you're going to proceed their way. Whether it's right or wrong, you're going to proceed their way. Now, there are right but illegal actions, too. Great examples, whistleblowers, government whistleblowers. There was one some years back. She downloaded a pile, just a mass of secret documents. In those documents were videos of a gun camera from a gunship that had hosed down a group walking in Iraq. It was journalists with their security force, just killed them all. They weren't a threat. They were journalists and just killed them. It was illegal for her to release those, but it was probably right because at least then the families of those journalists knew what really happened to them. A gunship in Afghanistan circled a building that they'd seen terrorists being taken into. The gunships, there were two of them, circled the building, just mowing them down, killing everyone in them. Turned out it was a hospital run by Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. They were treating wounded. They didn't ask if some of the people being brought in there had been involved in terrorist acts. They were just, kids were killed, doctors were killed, nurses were killed, volunteers were killed. Everyone in there was just wasted. It was legal. Was it right for them to do it? Yes. Under rules of engagement and the Geneva Convention, it was illegal as hell, but they got by with it. And that says nothing about what the nutcase terrorists do. But you see, there's the matrix. Now, I want to bring up philosophy. I caution you, I have a minor in philosophy, so this will be a little bit painful, but you can take two basic approaches to how you conduct your business as how you conduct your life. Now, you want to avoid, any time you can, waving a religion in this, because you can do this without invoking that. You will see that religions actually do reflect these concepts, but there is this one that was advanced by a philosopher 300 years ago or so named Immanuel Kant. It was called the categorical imperative. Now, follow me as I tell you what the categorical imperative is. In all situations, you act as you would expect rightful action from others. In all situations, you act as you would expect others to rightfully act. It sounds like that's the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. No. This is about anything, not just to you, but to everything. There is not a situation, well, it's different here. You act always in a categorical way. In other words, there is a core of convictions you have. You don't act, and the code of conduct is nothing but a derivative of this underlying core of convictions. The code reads back up into your core of convictions in every situation. That's a categorical imperative. Contrast that with the philosophies that came mostly in the 19th century that were situational. And there's several different varieties of them. Situational ethics. The most popular, and I won't lay them all out for you, but the most popular is a utilitarian view. Do what is best for the most people. Do what is best for the greatest common. That would be utilitarianism. Now, interestingly, we have tried, that's a lot of the way we conduct ourselves in government tends to move towards this idea, this philosophy. Okay, we're going to do things that are going to benefit most, and they might hurt some, but overall, they advance our society. There's a deep, deep problem with this. And every time, and you'll see it, it actually causes a shaken sense of confidence in utilitarianism when it sneaks up to the surface every now and then. Let me try this. Madam, you are in charge of overseeing the studies on a new drug. New drugs of a pharmaceutical company. Now, you have gone through clinical trials, the different phases, and the FDA has cleared everything out. This is a drug that actually will cure a form of cancer in children. So everything is clear. You're going to make the announcement the next day, and then you have one of the lead research assistants come into your office and sit down with you. And he said, well, here's the deal. This does indeed work. What they didn't tell you, and that we were able to, and the lead researchers were able to fix this, is that it does cure about 98 of every 100 kids. But it also terminates very quickly two children's lives. Whereas they might live for a year to 2 years taking this drug, they are killed within a week by it. The other kids are all cured. What are you going to do? You going to do the announcement tomorrow? We have this miracle drug. It's cleared the FDA. So in other words, you're going to say that the company's stock price, which has been going up on the expectations of this drug, you're going to say we're delaying the announcement. The markets are going to know exactly what's going on. Boom! Through the floor. Wall Street boys are going to call in your chief executive officer, your chief financial officer, and the seeing eye dog they use to hire you and ask all about it. And they're going to quietly fire your ass. What are you going to do? Still what you said? You're a damn whistleblower. You see the greatest good. You see this is utilitarian. 98 kids are going to be cured of a cancer. But two kids are going to die much faster than they would have if they had just ridden out the cancer. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Do the announcement or just say no? Well, that'll drive the stock price right through the floor. We're back where we were. You're going to have to do something. Okay. What if one of those two kids was yours? Ouch. You see, the problems that we face in business aren't always cut and dried easy. And saying, well, we're categorical imperativists or we're utilitarians, no matter how you cut it, it ain't going to be easy to deal with the realities of business life. There were ungodly ethical questions that I had during my time, and unfortunately, playing the good guy, the nice guy, was about the quickest way to die in that business. Unfortunately, they let me live, as long as I stay here in academia. Now, I'm going to go on here and show you something about being managers. They allude to this, interestingly enough, in your textbook. They actually mention this several times, but they never fully develop it. And most specifically, they never, and almost never do you see in a textbook in business, a full-blown press to the final story, which is actually one of the most important things you can be taught in business. But they don't even go close to where you could learn that, and I'm going to take you there today. But the first thing I have to do is to describe a scenario to you. Now, you, sir, you're driving down a highway out here on the prairie, one of those long stretches of country road. It's a beautiful sunny day. You're, and you see a sign that says 55 miles per hour. Well, you know, you people out here, you know what you say when you see that? You say, hold my beer. And you start putting down that accelerator. Fast. Don't say, oh, I sure don't do that. Yes, you do. I've seen you. You drive like a blind trout. Okay? I don't know what. Oh, yeah, I do. I saw you. That's a blind trout. Watch him drive. That's a blind trout. Wonder where the beer is. Okay, you're driving along. Faster and faster and faster. You hear a voice in the back of the car say, warp 6. And you begin to see stars streaming by you as you're driving along down the road. Okay? But then way up the road, you see in, you know, those cornfields, they have those little turns into them, and you see up there a car pulled into the, yep, farmer up there. RPMs are beginning to get into scientific notation on the... And as you get closer, you think, oh my God, that's a sheriff. That's a sheriff's deputy's car. What are you going to do? Are you on crack? No. Okay, you're driving along. You see that sheriff's deputy. Most normal. Have you ever noticed how all the cars are flying past you and all of a sudden their brake lights come on? Well, that's when they find Jesus because there's a highway patrolman driving along up there. You begin to slow down because you're being monitored. But as you get closer, you see the deputy standing out in front of the car. Oh, God, he's got a radar gun. Oh, wait, he stooped. Oh, he's changing the tire on his car. So you just bring up that accelerator again. You wave at him. Hi, officer. Because he can't enforce. The two necessaries of management are that you can monitor and that you can enforce. Monitoring and enforcement. You can't do one and not the other. You can enforce, but if you're not monitoring, it doesn't matter. You can monitor, but if you're too cowardly to enforce or you're incapable of enforcing, it does not matter. You got no contract. You got nothing. So let's take this on a little bit here and go to the heart of the problem. You as managers will have. It's called the agency dilemma. The agency dilemma. Now, I warn you, when I use the word person, I'm using it in the law sense. A person can be an individual. It can be a group. It can even be something that's not even alive. A corporation is a person under the law. A partnership is a person. A marriage is a person. An army is a person. A person takes on another meaning in law. Unfortunately, our Supreme Court over the past 40 years has been nudging toward seeing personhood as equivalent to constitutional rights. And the most dramatic, it's been slipping that way for a long time. Dramatically, in a Citizens United was the case about, I think it was like 10 years ago maybe, the court said you cannot restrict corporations from contributing as much as they want to political candidacies because they're persons and persons are protected by free speech under the Constitution. And so that opened just a can of nightmares. And they think that the word person in law is the same as meaning the person in terms of rights in the and privileges in the Constitution. And so, I mean, there's no way to undo what they've done, and it wasn't just one thing. Like I said, this had been going on for a long time. But do recognize when I'm saying person here, I'm talking about a legal entity. And it could be a one, two, many, or whatever, or it doesn't even have to be a living thing at all. But okay, so keep that in mind. The agency dilemma. When one person called the agent, is responsible under contract with maximizing the welfare of another person called the principal
That's P-A-L. The agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead. Now, understand that I'm saying it has incentive. That doesn't mean it will, but it has incentive. And when you act in any business or war or other conflict environment, you do not make decisions based upon intentions. You make them based upon capabilities. That's the first rule of warfare. Never assume intentions of your opponent, only capabilities. So in other words, if there is an agent, then that agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of that of the principal. So take a couple of examples. Let's go, first of all, a good example of agent and principal. The principal is the shareholders as a body. The agents are the board of directors and the executives of the company. Because the board of directors and the executives are supposed to maximize the welfare of the shareholders as a body. That's their job. But they do have incentives otherwise. Let's try a couple of others. A doctor-patient relationship. Who's the agent, who's the principal in a doctor-patient relationship?
The doctor would be the agent.
Good, because his job is to maximize the health of the patient, the principal. Let's try another one. It gets a little more dicier here as we go along. Sir, in a parent-child relationship, who's the agent and who's the principal? Good. The child is the principal because the agent is there to maximize the welfare of the principal. The parent is there to maximize the welfare of the child. You understand that? Let's do another one, and I will warn you to be cautious because I will call on a gentleman to answer this one. In a marriage, who is the agent and who is the principal? And I caution you again, think about your teeth. The ambulance is coming for you if you answer wrong. Talk to me.
The woman be the agent, the male be the principal?
Oh, dude. No friendship for you tonight. Madam, what do you say? Who's the agent, who's the principal? In a marriage. You got anything, madam? Well, is the husband the agent and the wife the principal, or is the husband the principal and the wife the agent? Which is it? Here's a hint. It's neither. The marriage is the principal. The man and woman are the agents. They are both charged with maximizing the welfare of a person called the marriage. That's their job, is to maximize the welfare of the marriage. So they are dual agents in the person, and I guarantee you that marriage is a person under the law. You two are one under the law through the contract of the marriage. You follow? It's interesting. Sometimes it's difficult. Now, here's an odd one. A soldier. He's clearly an agent. What's he an agent of? What's, can you tell me? Oh, no. Any of you have been in the service, prior service, or there? The oath. I swear to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. The Constitution is the principle. It's just a piece of paper. It has no life until it is animated by the defense of it through the agents. That's your sworn oath. Here's a problem, though. Now let's talk about the agency dilemma. In a marriage, for example, you, sir, are charged as the husband, just like your wife is, with maximizing the welfare of the marriage, right? So she's out of town, and you get a phone call. This is 4 years from now. Ring, ring, ring. Hello? Hi, this is some friends of yours from the sorority. Remember at ISU? And we're having a bong and a pong festival, and there's going to be a twerkathon, and we wish for you to be one of the judges. Do you see the incentive to maximize your own welfare there? Do you see it? Good. What are you going to do? Be right over. You understand what I'm showing you? That's it. Now, let me tell you. Okay, are any of you parents in here yet? Okay. Here's how it works. Now, you might not have been there yet, but eventually you will. Now, you see, you're just worn out. You come dragging in. You're tired. It's been a long day. Now your kids are, they're in the house, they're just going insane, bouncing off the walls, one of them jumping up and down on the couch, they're riding on the walls, and just going crazy. Now what you are supposed to do as the agent, you run up and you grab your kids, oh sweeties, come on, let's go, I'm going to make you a nutritious meal, you know, from scratch, and then I'm going to put you in a bath and I'll read you some bookies, oh I love you so much, and then I'll tuck you in and make you feel all safe and all that. You know what you're really going to do? You're going to drag in there. Oh, God. You stop it. Knock it out. God damn it. You stop jumping here. Take my belt. Beat yourself with it. You're bad. Have some nuke and puke. It's in the freezer. Put it in the microwave. 5 minutes. Go ahead. 10 minutes. It might be bacteria in it. You think that's all? You wait. You wait. You see, the point is that we are supposed to do things as agents, but we will cut corners. We will find ways around it. We will justify what we are doing in one way or another. We'll find a way to cut the corners. Now, this is management. Oh, my employees are all really good people and all of that. They aren't going to do anything. I can just sit on my fat ass in here and everything will just run smoothly. That ain't going to happen. And as a matter of fact, we in finance, we are dedicated to finding value in the cost. Even when it's hidden, we need to know what it is. So we say that agents will extract cost in five ways. The agency costs. This way we can break it down, what is going on. What is the cost of this to our firm? Now remember, just because of the cost doesn't mean you get rid of it. You'll reduce a cost to the point where getting rid of another dollar of the cost costs you more than just letting the cost run there. In other words, if someone steals paper clips, do I really want to spend on a giant monitoring system to watch the paper clips? It's not going to be worth it. But in some cases, okay, well, let me get to them. The first one is perquisites. Perquisites are benefits taken by virtue of position. Benefits taken by virtue of position. You often hear them called perks. That is the executive that has a desk in his office the size of the landing zone on an aircraft carrier. That is the executives who fly a private jet to a meeting two states away. That is the inappropriate use of shareholder funds. I've been taken to these dinners by corporations. Oh, we're going to take you along with us. Let's have you be there. They're eating at a five-star restaurant. The bill can knock you dead. That was shareholder money. They took it. It went onto the meals and entertainment expense line on their financial statements. It never got to the shareholders, the principals, because the agents could do it because they would not be caught. They would not be criticized. Well, we have to have these kinds of deals. One of the corporations a few years ago said, you know, we've got the comptroller's position is open. You could make so much more than that here. Than I said, you don't want me. First of all, that private jet, Greyhound goes to most major cities. And as far as meals go, McDonald's is open 24/7. Mm-hmm. And as far as hotels go, not five-star hotels you guys are used to. Motel 6. As a matter of fact, there are even lower-class motels, and for a quarter, you really get a good time. Two, shirking. Deliberately avoiding your duties. Deliberately avoiding your duties. This is the office worker who goes around yakking and chatting with people all day. This is the smoke break that goes on for 15 minutes. Really? What kind of a cigarette was that? This is the manager. Oh, I love this one. The manager, you may have even seen this one. There's this famous one. Matter of fact, I'll tell you two stories about this one corporation. But the one, this slightly upper level manager, he said, my desk is clear every night. I go home, I make sure my desk is clear every night. You know what he does? He puts all his work on his subordinate's desk. They walk in the morning, yeah. Shirking his duties, handing them off down the chain because he can. That's shirking. Now the next one, shirking. Oh, the same corporation, shirking. A manager, not the same one, it wasn't actually. Every morning, he came in like clockwork, breezed in the front door of the building at 8 o'clock on the button, walked past the receptionist desk, grabbed the Wall Street Journal, went into the men's toilet, and he sat there 40 minutes. It was magnificent. The man was so freaking regular. I thought, what vegetables do you eat? Every morning. And I've noticed it after about a week. And I asked, he does that every morning. Every morning for the last 10 years he's been here, he goes in there and craps for 40 minutes reading the Wall Street Journal. And then he comes out and does his work. He looks really refreshed, perky. Shirking. Don't tell me you couldn't have done that at home or you could wait or, you know. Anyway. Three. Theft. You steal. They're not going to notice a couple of pencils or, my kids need some paper for some homework. I'm going to grab that. You paid the exact change for your meal here at this line. So, and all these people are behind you wanting to hurry up. So I'm just going to set this change here on the side and go on to the next order. Can I help you? Ching, ching, ching. You see the trick? It's an old one. It's one that's really hard to catch, too. You have to have cameras in right places. Pay-through lines, if you got exact change, they'll just take your change and put it on the counter. You're glad you just leave, and the people behind you come up because they're glad because you didn't waste time working out the bill and all that, and then when the time comes, you just lean forward and move the money into your apron. Direct theft. I mean, there's all kinds of direct theft. It's in billions of dollars. And it's not just low-level employees. It's high-level employees do it too, except they're respectable, so no one ever suspects that they're doing it. Four, lying. Lying. Now, there are a couple of different versions of lying. You've got to be careful about this. There is lying, you are just not going to do what you're supposed to do, or you're going to blame someone who isn't to blame. That's you're just lying. Then there's a version of it. Some managers get an ego kick out of pushing employees and actually pitting them against each other so that they lie, and then that manager can say you're all liars and put you down, embarrass you, write you up. I've seen that one. It's a nasty game run by Cluster B sociopaths, who tend to have a bad habit of rising in corporations. Cluster B is the sociopaths and the narcissistic personality disorders. It's actually more the NPDs that you've run into, and they get a kick out of forcing people and making them feel like they're compelled to lie because they didn't get something done within a ridiculously short amount of time, that kind of thing. So you got to watch it. Is it the employee lying just because the employee is trying to get out from responsibility for something, or are you putting the employee in a situation where that's the best choice of bad choices? And now there's this one. Have you ever met the fifth agency cost? Have you ever met, or have you ever worked with someone who was too stupid to live?
Yes.
Ah, Yahtzee. You are the dumbest fark I have ever met in my life. You make a box of rocks look like a PhD. If there were candles in the window, you would not be in the window. You would be in the trash can because we couldn't get you to light. Incompetence. Now, you have to understand that incompetence is actually an essential element of business. This was brought to understanding some years back by a management expert named Dr. Peter, and it came to be known as the Peter Principle. A lot of people at the time he published the book, The Peter Principle, thought it was a joke. It was not. It was actually a necessary, it's a logical consequence of business. It works like this. All employees will rise to their level of incompetence. All employees will rise to their level of incompetence. Now let me explain what that means. You, what's your major? Okay. You have just gotten your first job out of college in our discipline. You are magnificent. I mean, you can do the Excel, you understand ratio analysis, you understand risk and return, you have that gift. I mean, we give you projects, you just get them done. Just boom, you're great, you're awesome. So after a year, what we do is we promote you one step. You have a couple of people, you supervise, and we're impressed. That's meritocracy. We're not going to waste a good employee. We're going to raise your salary and all that. Well, again, you're just incredible. You do everything well. We're proud of you. We've even brought you to a couple of board meetings, and you were professional. You knew your stuff. It was awesome. You were an animal. And so we promote you again. This time you're a head of a division that handles the capital budgeting process from the finance side, working with the accounting and all that. You're great. You're really a good worker. I mean, you're just doing everything really well. There's a darkness down deep in your soul, though. You wouldn't certainly tell anyone about it, but it comes out in odd ways. You overfeed your cats. You know, you tend to watch a really bad series on Netflix. And, I mean, there have even been rumors that you kind of listen to dubstep. But that's deep in you. You've been promoted a couple of times more, and you're still doing great. But now that nagging sense is really there at the top. I can do what I'm doing now. I'm really responsible. I'm the junior financial officer. But, whoa. And then one day, in the office, something terrible happens. The little muzak that plays on the speakers to make everyone soothe and calm suddenly shuts off, and the music changes, and it's loud. Ba 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 ba. And oh my God, it's the chief financial officer of the company. My God. No, it's the chief executive officer. And in comes me.
And I walk right up to you. You have been incredible. I've heard wonderful things about you. I just lost my chief financial officer. He stopped breathing for some reason. And I need a new chief financial officer, and it is going to be you. I will want you to run the finances of our entire mega corporation. Together we can rule the galaxy. Join me or die. And one other thing. The keys to the Imperial restroom, yours. You know you can't do that job. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Fake it? Is that what you said? You see, most people would take the job. You're not going to be foolish. You're going to take the job and hope to God you can have enough underlings to do the work. See, that's what the Peter principle is talking about, is people will just keep rising until they get to the level where they can't do the job, and then they just stay there. Coaches, that's classic in coaching. You're a great assistant coach. You're a great second coach. And then you put them up there at the top, and what do you get? The Cleveland Browns. You understand what I'm saying, though. I'm showing you this is a very normal process. Whenever you walk into a corporation, the one you're going to work for, you look around you. Everyone is either on the road to or has achieved his or her level of incompetence. We are all on that road. You are, I am, the chiefs, the executive officers. We are all on the road to finding the place where we get so high that we can't go any further up the chain. That's the Peter principle. That's incompetence. There's one problem with this whole model. And it amazes me. I've asked professors, do you teach this? There are some agent-principal relationships where the principal actually can't do what is he or she is supposed to. Understand that the agency dilemma tells us that it is not the agent's fault. It is the principal's fault. The principal must monitor and enforce. You have to assume your employees are going to do that crap. Whether or not they do, that doesn't matter. It is your job as the principal. Your job to monitor and enforce. Not the agent. The agent is going to do what the agent does. The agent is either a human or some entity that maximizes its own welfare. But there are a few special relationships where the principal cannot monitor and enforce. Think about a doctor-patient relationship. You, the patient, are the principal. You can't monitor and enforce the doctor's behavior because you are not trained. And if you're under anesthesia, you have no idea what that doctor, he could be pulling out your colon going, do, 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 do. Hey, watch this. I'm going to tattoo his liver. Did you read about that doctor who was tattooing people's livers? Oh, that's nasty. That's weird. He was signing his work. Really? You know, I'm an artist. I mean, yeah, I guess I understand pride of workmanship and all that. Okay. Parent-child. The child is the principal. The child doesn't know what's right and wrong about your actions as a parent. In these relationships where the principal cannot monitor and enforce, we have something special. It's called a fiduciary relationship. A fiduciary relationship is one where the principal cannot monitor and enforce. This is ancient common law, going back thousands of years. The fiduciary relationship is characterized by trust, loyalty, and fidelity. Faithfulness. The ancient concept of the knight protecting the crown, the king. The ancient concept of the
parent protecting the children. The ancient concept. It is not based upon a contract in law. Well, it is a contract in law oftentimes, but it is actually a moral duty. Fiduciary duty is talked about all the time, and you're going to have it in your work. That's all I have for you. I thank you.